in this world, of course, and, you know, falling into catastrophes. So they knew that this change that they wanted cannot happen. Mm-hmm. So they stood quiet.
There has to be a criteria.
Exactly.
Yeah, so we go back to the hadith, yeah, Dhaful Iman, which, yeah, is even like at the time of the Imams, like you mentioned, I read some hadith. Imam Sadiq Salamullah Alayhi, even when his companions come to him, he would curse them publicly, yeah, just so he avoids them from
his
being
cousins,
known.
Imam Baqir Alayhi, yeah, Salam, Imam Baqir's cousins, they would fight a revolt, they would be killed, they would come to tell the Imam, he would cry. He would say, "Why are you crying? Why didn't you fight with them?" Yeah. He said, "I'm crying because this is my cousin."
Yeah.
And he did something wrong.
Exactly.
To stand up.
Yeah,
at that
but
time.
Sometimes I think what the sister was saying is sometimes when it comes to oppression, sometimes you have to make a stand, even if it's going to get you killed for the higher purpose. For example, Imam Hussein alayhi salam did.
Definitely.
Obviously, if he done what the other Imams did, Islam would have gone. The other Imams, salamullah alayhim, they did not, at least, you know, like you said, you hate the word uprights or revolt or whatever. They did not, because they said, you know what, things are okay, we can manage it, all right? For example, what's his name, that guy? Was it the guy that stood to one of the Khulafa of Banu al-Abbas, and when he said to him, who is better, Imam Hassan Hussein or my two sons? Al-Hakkak, al-Sakkak, I think was his name?
He was the teacher.
Yeah, he was a teacher. And so this guy, he was sitting in the majlis of this Khalifa, and a lot of people sitting. Now, if he denounced Imam Hassan Hussein alayhi salam, he might weaken the heart of the Shia, right? So he's like, no, I had to make a stand. He said to him, the shoe of Umbar, not Hassan Hussein, the shoe of Umbar is better than you and your sons. So he had to make a stand to prove to the Shia, to have that strength. So there are times where even if your life is in danger, you have to make that stand.
You're listening to Back to Reality. We're going to be back after a short break, so don't go anywhere.
Oh, shahidan to ya Hussein. Oh, arsar khan to ya Hussein. Oh, edelam asrat Karbala. Oh, Karbala, Karbala, Karbala. Karbala, Karbala, Karbala.
Thank you so very much for being with us on Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have two very special guests, Brother Habib and Brother Abdullah. We're talking about the proper stance you could take in order not to fall under the category of those who are silent. Who is the one who determines this line?
The person himself has to understand the situation. You ask yourself the split question that if I stand up, first of all, am I going to make a change? Is there something that might change? Is there something that's going to remain the same if I do it?
I really don't believe that in the complex system of this universe, there's any such thing as something being done without creating change. It creates ripples and influences.
No, there have been a lot of tried attempts. Look, nothing changed. Nothing changed.
You can't say that, Habib. You can't say that. Any blood gets shed for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it will have a small wave. Sooner or later, it will take effect. Imam Hussein salamullah alayhi thawra, his whole Karbala, it didn't take effect.
It didn't change anything. You, Brother Habib,
years.
Are one of those
it took
people
years.
Who firmly
Imam Hussein
believed.
For years and years, like through the Umayyad dynasty and the Abbas dynasty, the thawra did not take its full, did not come to its
it
full.
It didn't ripen.
Yeah. Until generations came after. So whatever happened in Iraq, in Iraq I could do the same thing. I could say to you, Saddam Hussein ruled Iraq with an iron fist for about 40 years, and he killed millions of people. And you could say, well, all these small guys, my dad and his friends hiding somewhere in the bushes.
What changes did they bring
about?
Anything.
But obviously it does. On the long term, everything does.
It does have an effect.
It does have an effect.
But is my death, for example, how about if Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to do ihmal?
Just give him a, you know, test. Like he would
delay their punishment. Allah wanted to delay their punishment. What then?
No, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala delays the punishment. But that effort that they put is not going to go to waste. Even Allah says himself, لَا نُضِعْ أَجْرَ عَامِلٍ مِنْكُمْ.
What does that mean?
We will not lose or forfeit any ajr, any reward, or any action that you guys done.
Mm.
So it will always remain. So Allah might use people who died for his sake as a hujjah on other people, even on the day of judgment. So you can't say, well, the people in Bahrain, many of them, you know, the whole revolution in Bahrain failed miserably. But a lot of people got killed. A lot of people are in prison. But these people will be even used as a hujjah on those
confused.
Who refuse.
I'm
to.
Still confused. You still haven't answered my question as to where do we draw the line? How does a person, especially in today's situation where you don't have a physically available ma'asum whose door you can knock immediately and address your questions to, and there's so much sedition and there's so much controversy and confusion among the Islamic nation itself, let alone oppressive forces that are blatantly and clearly fighting against Islam. How is a person supposed to determine what's the right thing to do right
it's
now?
Simple.
How is he supposed to know that, do I fall under the category of those who do something, even if it risks the life of myself and my loved ones, because sooner or later the effects are going to create a ripple in universe, or I am one of those mustada'afin, I'm one of those oppressed or those deprived people who can't do anything and I might have to migrate to another country.
Mm-hmm.
Who draws the line?
The person himself draws the line.
How?
I'm telling
based
you
based on what criteria?
Based on the criteria that, you know, we, I'm not sure if this is a hadith or not, but it along the lines that everyone needs to be aware of his own times. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So whatever time you live in, your duty as a Muslim or as a human being to recognize the time and the people that you live in. Right? So the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, when he came to Mecca, his mission wasn't to get people to pray and fast. He wasn't to get people to believe in Allah, even though that was part of his mission. But his mission was to get people to understand that there is a messenger of God, which is me, and there is something that you need to follow. There's something that you need to understand what's happening, right?
Mm.
So understanding the circumstances is a duty of mine and yours. I could live ignorantly and say, well, it's not my problem that the world burn as long as I'm happy. Or no, I open my eyes. I see, well, where am I living? Who is the imam of my time? What are my responsibilities? What are my duties? These are questions you need to ask yourselves. Once you become familiar with these things, then you can say, okay, my duty right here is to make a stand.
All right, so you're saying at the end of the day, it all boils down to priorities.
Not priorities. Obviously, there are priorities, but it boils down to the fact that you need to
know yourself.
Realize where you are.
For one time in your life, open your eyes, look at the world outside you, understand the situation, the area you're living in, and then understand your situation.
That's what the hadith says. Man arafa nafsa arafa rabba. If you know yourself, you know your Lord. Know yourself as in... know where you are. What are you doing? Who are you with? For example, if I was in Australia...
Because a lot of people chase after the meaning of life, but they don't reach the meaning you are trying to emphasize right here in order to act as a means for them to fight against oppression. A lot of people go soul-searching. A lot of people go to find spirituality and enlightenment and awareness and inner peace and things like that. But they are totally unbothered by the circumstances
oblivious
of life and who's oppressive and who's oppressed. As long as they're living their best life, drinking 1.5 liters of water a day, their skin is glowing and they're not hurting anyone. They don't care if someone else is hurting someone
else. That's
what
I said at the beginning. I said
so it's priorities.
I said, I have people like that. How do I know when I make a stand?
When you have priorities.
Not when you have because if someone's priority is just to wander around, it's going to do with oppression.
That's all the time we have for today's episode of the show. Thank you so very much, gentlemen, for being with us and to our listeners for joining us. Until the next episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
شهیدان تو یا حسین آه ار سر خان تو یا حسین آه
Round the World with Reporters.
NATO has just concluded its 17th annual arms control conference with harsh criticism directed towards authorities in Moscow, Beijing, Pyongyang and Tehran. NATO, led by the United States, continues to spend billions on military hardware, but clearly does not like it when nations outside the alliance develop their own defense capabilities.
There are also other players fielding nuclear weapons and advanced missile systems. North Korea and Iran, for example, are blatantly ignoring or breaking the global rules.
Iran has always stressed its nuclear program is purely peaceful. In fact, Tehran did all in its power to reassure the international community by signing up to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in 2015. It was the United States under Donald Trump that illegally withdrew from that nuclear accord. Stoltenberg failed to mention this once during his speech. In any case, experts say NATO is not in a position to point the finger. There are significant divisions within the 30-nation alliance. Its credibility is currently at rock bottom, critics argue, following its 20-year-long mission in Afghanistan.
The European member states of NATO will need to come up with real arguments to demonstrate that NATO makes values. You need to demonstrate the return on investment.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, concluded his address to the Arms Control Conference with these words.
You can count on NATO's commitment to security and stability.
That statement will likely cut to the bone for any Afghan citizen able to hear it. Anti-war campaigners say the destruction NATO countries brought to Afghanistan during the past two decades cannot be put into words. And now those Afghan civilians who somehow managed to survive have no idea what the future holds. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have celebrated the escape of six Palestinian inmates from Israeli maximum security Jabal prison in north of the occupied territories through a tunnel dug in the floor. Palestinians hailed the heroic operation and handed out candies to celebrate what they call a heroic move. Palestinian factions consider the escape as a slap in the face of the Israeli regime.
This operation is a great victory for our Palestinian prisoners, the resistance, and our Palestinian people. What happened in Jabal prison is unique. Our inmates grabbed their freedom by themselves, leaving the Israeli security defeated and confused. We are celebrating this victory as we call on all Palestinians to provide safety for those inmates.
Prisoners' groups said four of the inmates were serving life sentences. Another man was held under a special detention order, and the sixth was awaiting a verdict. Five of them belong to the Islamic Jihad movement, and one is a former commander in Fatah Party.
This escape has damaged the image of the Israeli regime before the world. It is such a great victory for Palestinians. We warn the Israeli regime against doing any action that puts the lives of those heroes at risk.
Palestinian resistance movements emphasized that the struggle for freedom with the Israeli occupation persists both behind bars and outside.
This is the biggest prison break in the history of the Palestinian cause, and it's going to be a remarkable incident in history. As Palestinian resistance, we hail these inmates' efforts of grabbing back their freedom and breaking the Israeli chains. We warn Israel not to hurt those prisoners, or else this will cost the Israeli regime a lot.
Palestinians have praised the heroic escape of the Palestinian inmates, describing it a blow to the Israeli regime and its security. They also stressed that the resistance is the only way to defend their rights and liberate their lands. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Voices of dissent outside Europe's biggest weapons fair, euphemistically called Defense and Security Equipment International, DSEI. More than 37,000 delegates descending on the British capital this year for a close encounter of the military kind, with more than 1,700 companies and dozens of governments here to buy or sell. Some are offering surveillance equipment, other manufacturers marketing all manner of lethal hardware, among them those who profited immensely from the so-called War on Terror. the UK claims that it's leading the way in ethical arms sales.
We have a procedure that follows the consolidated criteria that is very clear around humanitarian law. We have in place a rigorous and robust process.
That is a claim dismissed by groups such as Stop the Arms Fair. They say by hosting the weapons show, Britain is perpetuating conflict and putting profit before human lives.
This arms fair wouldn't happen without the UK's support, the government's support. The defence and security exports team of the government makes sure that this arms fair happens. They know that human rights abusing countries are coming here to buy weapons that are made by UK companies and also foreign companies that we host in our country.
Campaigners also point out that several countries specifically invited here, such as the UAE, Egypt, and Bahrain, are on the UK government's human rights watch list.
The fact that we're hosting such hideous weaponry and we are actually inviting oppressive regimes and dictatorships to come and buy this weaponry, knowing that it will be used against the people of Palestine, knowing it's going to be dropped on the heads of the people of Yemen, is appalling.
In recent years, short of 60% of British arms exports have gone to the Middle East, accounting for billions of dollars in sales. Most of that business has gone to Saudi Arabia, which, according to many rights groups, has killed hundreds of thousands of civilians in indiscriminate airstrikes in Yemen.
Since 2015, the UK government has approved hundreds of arms export licenses to Saudi Arabia, worth more than $9 billion. Of that figure, nearly $2 billion came between July and September last year, after a court here rejected a legal challenge to ban weapon sales to the kingdom, a move slammed by critics as immoral.
The UK also sells record amounts of arms to Israel, lending support to Tel Aviv's militarized repression of Palestinians. Campaigners in Britain's political opposition are calling for an immediate change in government policy. But while they point out a shift in public opinion in recent years, the arms fair and the multi-billion dollar worldwide industry that drives it shows every sign of growing. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The Taliban spokesman has declared the collapse of Panjshir Valley in the north of Kabul. Zabihullah Mujahid says the war is over in Afghanistan and that there is no anti-Taliban resistance in the country, except by Daesh.
The war is ended all over Afghanistan after successfully capturing Panjshir province as the last stronghold for the ousted enemy. The Islamic Emirate forces have active presence in the valley.
However, the leader of National Resistance Front says he is in Panjshir and that his forces are deployed across the strategic areas of the valley. According to Massoud, the resistance will push ahead with its fight on the Taliban until victory is achieved. In an audio message, Massoud called on all Afghans to come together and stand against the Taliban.
I call on all my countrymen inside and abroad to launch a national uprising to defend our dignity, independence, and freedom. I also call on the international community to be aware that the Taliban has never changed.
The leader of National Resistance Front also slammed the Taliban for what he called defying the demand of a top delegation of religious scholars to engage in talks to resolve the conflict in Panjshir. He also accused Pakistan of directly invading Afghanistan, saying the Pakistani military used drones to bomb Panjshir to help the Taliban. Ahmed Massoud's claim on the Pakistani military interference in Panjshir has complicated the situation. On Monday, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman was asked about the reports of Pakistani airstrikes. The spokesman said Iran condemns all foreign interference in Afghanistan without specifying any country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
A two-day meeting of G20 health ministers wrapped up in the Italian capital on Monday, ensuring sustainable development in a post-pandemic world and preventing future pandemics were among the issues discussed by the group. At the end of the meeting, Roberto Speranza, the health minister of Italy, which holds the G20 presidency this year, announced the unanimous adoption of the Pact of Rome and the pledge that the Group of 20 will make sure the world's population has access to COVID-19 vaccines.
Ma dobbiamo necessariamente rendere altre aree del...
We want to build the conditions to make it possible to take the COVID-19 vaccines to the most fragile countries. Furthermore, with the Pact of Rome, it was decided to make a commitment to reinforce the health systems.
Now that public health and social measures have been relaxed in many countries, COVID vaccination rates have slumped in some parts of the world, and authorities are worried. G20 health ministers have stressed that the public's vaccination is crucial.
The G20 talks have taken place against the backdrop of a flaming debate over the so-called Green Pass, a mandatory proof of anti-COVID vaccination. The Italian government is considering extending its Green Pass to all employees in the public sector, but part of the ruling coalition is against it.
The Italian government has already made the Green Pass mandatory for school staff and for passengers on long-distance public transport. This has prompted a swath of protests across Italy over the past months. About 37.5 million Italians, out of a population of less than 60 million, have received both COVID vaccine doses so far. Italian authorities aim at vaccinating 80% of the population by the end of September, a target that seems unlikely to be met. Max Civili, Rome.
The EU Rule of Law Report 2021 singles out Hungary, Poland, Bulgaria, Croatia and Slovenia for particular criticism. It reaches conclusions but provides zero recommendations.
It's toothless and spineless because what we have is a carefully worded partial account of threats to the rule of law without any joining of the dots, without any calling things out as they are.
The European Commission's Rule of Law report was published in July. This is the first opportunity members of the European Parliament, MEPs, have had to debate it. Some governments in the EU are accused of corruption, stifling media freedom, and interfering in judicial systems.
Such as Austria, for example, where public prosecutors responsible for high-profile corruption cases have been confronted with negative portrayals by government representatives.
Calls have been made for EU funding to be withheld.
No money from the recovery plan can be used by these oligarchs to further capture the state and further organize elections in their favor. We should be very, very serious about that.
Far-right EU lawmakers were criticized during the debate.
You protect a Hungarian autocrat who gives money to everywhere there in dark channels in corruption.
Legislators say EU governments are failing to ensure human rights and promote religious tolerance. It's a particular issue for Jews and Muslims.
For me, Muslims are two times victims. One, as a citizen like you and me, but secondly, because their religion is hijacked by extremists to make a horrible thing of it.
The European Commission has powers to enforce rule of law, but is accused of not using them.
It is a problem for all of us. It's a problem because this spreads. And also, it's a problem when the Commission doesn't manage to act properly.
Some MEPs are asking the question, why is it EU leaders are so quick to apply sanctions on foreign nations for alleged rule of law breaches, but turn a blind eye when one of their own nations steps out of line? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Lebanon is in a day of national mourning after the passing of head of the Supreme Islamic Shiite Council in Lebanon at the age of 85. Sheikh Abdel Amir Qabalan was viewed by those who knew him as not only a religious figure, but a national figure who strove for the best interest of the country.
Lebanon's problem doesn't lie in its religious or sectarian diversity, but in some corrupt officials who hide behind their sects and call on their followers to move away from their genuine belief. Sheikh Qabalan, along with other clerics, exerted all efforts to keep the sectarian diversity as national treasure. Lebanon cannot be a transit area for the Zionists or the U.S. It should be a symbol of resistance and national pride as he wanted.
The deceased cleric was known for his moderation and therefore his impact on mediating talks between Lebanese political groups.
The demise of Sheikh Gamelan comes at a critical time for Lebanon, which is unprecedented in Lebanon's history. Lebanon needs such figures at this stage. He was someone open to all sides in Lebanon, whether political or religious. He had always called for solving our internal crisis peacefully. Also, he was a supporter of the resistance.
In a statement, the Speaker of the Parliament, Nabih Birri, stressed that Ayatollah Gamelan followed in the footsteps of Imam Musa Sadr in moderation, coexistence, and resisting deprivation and occupation.
Ayatollah.
Sheikh Gamelan's demise is a great loss for Lebanon and the Muslim world. We all know he was among the close companions of Sayyid Musa al-Sadr, and together they worked for the poor and the oppressed. They established the Supreme Islamic Shiite Council, which serves as a center for congregation and dialogue for all Lebanese. We pray that this sad occasion could push the Lebanese officials to put differences aside and quickly form a cabinet, since Lebanon is in dire need for an active government.
Caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab declared Tuesday the day of the funeral procession for the spiritual leader as a national holiday.
Throughout his life, Sheikh Gamelan called on everyone to preserve the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine. He also preached unity among the Lebanese and Muslims, a move which made him a mediator on many occasions. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
As the world battles extraordinary refugee crisis for decades, hundreds of Afghans who have arrived in India after the Taliban take over of their country, they have been protesting outside the UN refugee office in New Delhi, demanding refugee status, justice, and protection for their women and children. Experts say India is not a signatory to the 1951 UN Refugee Convention or the 1967 protocols relating to the status of refugees. Therefore, it would be a challenging task to deal with another refugee influx. In India, where internal migration has been one of the most challenging tasks for the country due to huge population and possible mismanagement of the refugee policies. Observers say another refugee exodus could be a hard job for the country, considering its complex bureaucratic registration process. They say the country needs a uniform refugee policy. As India has no specific program for refugees, it allows the UNHCR to operate a program for them. Based on reports, thousands of Afghans are registered with the UN Refugee Agency, but there are many who are still demanding the refugee status despite arriving in India a decade ago. Experts say now the new influx might compel India to rethink its refugee policy.
Like many other nations and countries, India is home to a large group of and large chunk of refugees who come from their countries of origin to seek protection. But the confusion arises when we come to the mechanism, how India governs its refugees. In India, they have not a sound mechanism which can deal and which can protect these minorities.
A decade ago, scores of Afghan refugees arrived in India, leaving their war-torn country. But they still have trouble in accessing basic services like education, healthcare, and employment. Many are now demanding financial assistance due to lack of income. Others say they would return to their country, but are skeptical and still reeling from the violent past.
I think we have no future as the whole world is silent on our plight. The memories of violence still haunts us. I have a refugee card, but it does not help me as it should as a refugee. I urge the UN and the international community to pay urgent attention to us. We are worried for our future as our fate remains uncertain.
Despite India's rich history of ties with Afghanistan and home to hundreds of thousands of refugees from across the globe, the country has no clear-cut policy for refugees or any domestic law. Experts say by framing a concrete refugee law, India would be able to appropriately protect the rights of refugees. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Talks over the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal have faced a three-month hiatus following Iranian elections in June that brought Ebrahim Raisi to power. The European parties to the multilateral accord are now urging Iran to come back to negotiations. The new Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, says resuming the talks is on his agenda, but that they should not be held under Western pressure, and the U.S. must first lift all its sanctions against Iran.
will never run away from negotiations, but what the Westerners are trying to do, what Americans are trying to do, what they're pursuing is that they want to apply pressure. I mean, you could either have talks and dialogue, but at the same time, if you have pressure, well, what kind of negotiations are they? I mean, we need to have negotiations without pressure. That's not negotiation with pressure. So the threats that they are making against our people, these brutal sanctions, economic sanctions that they have imposed, this is not the issue of negotiations. I mean, that we're talking about.
Six rounds of talks on restoring the deal have so far been held in Austria's capital, Vienna, since April. The discussions are aimed at bringing the U.S. and Iran back to full compliance after Washington unilaterally abandoned the deal, and Tehran retaliated by scaling back its own commitments. The U.S. seeks a broader deal that would include Iran's missile program. But Tehran doesn't buy any such notion as negotiation for the sake of negotiation, says Iran's foreign ministry spokesman in his weekly briefing.
The Vienna talks are aimed at ensuring Iran's rights under the nuclear deal, which were violated by the U.S. lack of commitment and Europe's inaction toward the deal. So we are not negotiating a new deal.
Under the deal signed in 2015 between Iran and the six world powers, Tehran agreed to curb its nuclear activities in exchange for sanctions relief. In 2018, ex-U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the deal and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Tehran, in return, moved away from some of its obligations and resumed uranium enrichment to 20% purity. In the Vienna talks, Tehran vowed to reverse all of its retaliatory steps on the condition that Washington removes all its anti-Iran sanctions.
The new Iranian administration has not given any specific date as to when it will return to the Vienna talks. But what's clear is that the fate of the nuclear deal is equally important for Raisi as it was for the previous government, except it's not the first priority for the new Iranian president, as he doubts the U.S.'s sincerity in lifting the sanctions after six rounds of fruitless talks. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Another wide-scale operation was launched by the Yemeni army against the oil giant Aramco in several areas in Saudi Arabia. The spokesman of the Yemeni army said Yemen's air force has successfully targeted Aramco's oil facilities in Ras Tanura in Dammam with eight drones of Samathri type and a ballistic missile.
Our forces have targeted Aramco oil facilities in Ras Tanura in the Dammam region, eastern Saudi Arabia, with eight Samad 3 drones and a Zulfiqar ballistic missile.
Saria also added that Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jazan, and Najran were also successfully hit by five ballistic missiles and two drones of Samathri type. He then warned Riyadh against further attacks until the war on Yemen is stopped. Earlier, Saudi officials said they had intercepted ballistic missiles targeting eastern province as well as the cities of Najran and Jazan in the south. The attacks came in response to the years-long Saudi aggression against Yemen.
Yemen's army has no way but to intensify its attacks against Saudi Arabia amid the kingdom's aggression against the impoverished nation. Saudi Arabia uses all capabilities, targeting civilian areas in Yemen, destroying the country's infrastructures. The latest attacks by the Yemeni army serve as a tit-for-tat operation.
Saudi Arabia launched a deadly war against Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children, and displacing millions more.
People here hailed the Yemeni army for its retaliatory attacks on Saudi Arabia. They say Saudi Arabia will remain a legitimate target for them as long as it continues its aggression against the impoverished nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. According to a draft report issued recently, the United Nations body UNESCO is recommending that Australia's Great Barrier Reef be included on a list of World Heritage in Danger, a move which has been heavily criticised by the Australian government. We're prepared for you an article written by Graham Redfern. The piece is titled Why Australia's Great Barrier Reef May End Up on the World Heritage in Danger List and What It Means. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Janelle Chanona is a former television news anchor in Belize, the tiny Central American country on the Caribbean Sea, famed for its World Heritage Barrier Reef, the second largest on the planet. She said, "When things get really crazy above the waterline, I flee to the sea. Our reef speaks to the identity of every Belizean, and we say that with pride." Earlier this week, UNESCO recommended the planet's biggest, the Great Barrier Reef, should be placed on a list of World Heritage Sites in Danger. Janelle Chanona, who now leads a group of conservationists in the country for Oceania, knows exactly what that means. In 2009, the World Heritage Committee put Belize's Caribbean Jewel on the same list. Illegal fishing, coastal and island developments, and the threat of oil and gas drilling meant the country wasn't doing enough to preserve the site. But just as Australia is now staring down the barrel of a perceived ignominy of the danger tag, Belize now looks back at it. The country, bordered by Mexico and Guatemala, introduced a raft of new laws to stop the disappearance of mangroves, regulate fishing, and outlaw oil and gas exploration. In 2018, the World Heritage Committee scratched the in danger status. Now the Belize government has a new Ministry of Blue Economy and has renewed hope for its reefs. Janelle Chanona says, "We want to stay vigilant now." The University of Queensland marine biologist Professor Peter Mumby's career has straddled the two great reefs of Australia and Belize. His wife of 22 years is Belizean. He says the reef is very ingrained in their identity. He says even before Belize hit the danger list, fishermen were seeing the damage from overfishing, particularly on parrotfish, that helped clean the reef and were themselves lobbying the government to put restrictions on their catch. Professor Peter Mumby says both reefs are now being hit by climate change, but he worries a danger listing for Australia's Great Barrier Reef could reinforce a wrongly held perception globally that the reef is doomed. He says, but there does need to be that wake-up call to the Commonwealth government, adding, the reef is facing an uncertain future for sure. World Heritage sites are enshrined on the United Nations list for their cultural or natural significance, or sometimes both. There are 53 sites on the World Heritage in danger list, including Florida's Everglades, Indonesia's Sumatran rainforest, the city of Vienna, and Liverpool's historic waterfront, which could lose its World Heritage status entirely at next month's meeting. Next month's meeting, chaired by China, will decide the Great Barrier Reef status. UNESCO's recommendation is that the Great Barrier Reef should be placed under in danger list, and the next version of the Queensland and federal government's Cornerstone Joint Reef 2050 policy should be explicit about how Australia will bring greenhouse gas emissions down in line with the Paris Climate Agreement. If the committee accepts the recommendations in full, then UNESCO wants to carry out a monitoring mission to develop a set of corrective measures that would also look at driving improvements to water quality, another key area of concern. Some tourism figures in Queensland fear an in-danger listing will be more bad news that could discourage international visitors from travelling to Australia once borders reopen. Dr. John Day, a former Australian government representative on the World Heritage Committee and a veteran of the meeting, says, I really think that's a furphy. He says when other sites have been placed on the danger list, there's no indication that visitor numbers went down. He added, I really think that the international tourists are already well aware of the issue facing the Great Barrier Reef. Some tourism operators point out that there are still many great places to go on the Great Barrier Reef, and visitors are still as awed by their experience as ever. But Dr. John Day says those great areas that operators rightly identify won't continue to be great in the future. He added, it's really short-sighted perspective. Those great areas are going to be suffering very soon. He says if the Queensland Jewel does find itself on the danger list, there could be positives. It's not just a slap on the wrist, but actually a chance to bring this to the world's attention. Dr. John Day says Australia has always fought criticisms of the World Heritage properties, especially when the threat of an in danger listing is raised. He says Australia lobbied intensively to keep the Northern Territory's Kakadu National Park off the list in 1999, after concerns over uranium mining and its effects on Aboriginal sites. He says that's left a very sour taste in many countries' mouths. People still talk about it. He added, this should not be about arguing and fighting. It is about the world recognizing that its heritage is under threat and then doing something about it. Professor Tiffany Morrison of James Cook University led research published last year into all the times when the World Heritage Committee has considered putting natural sites, known in United Nations language as properties, on the danger list. Professor Tiffany Morrison found countries such as Australia, with economies dependent on high-value natural resources, regardless of their state of development, tended to push back on UNESCO's recommendations. Professor Tiffany Morrison said if the committee did ignore Australia's pleading this time, an appearance on the in danger list would mean Australia would need to start taking climate policy seriously. She added, we would hope that climate policy would get Australia back off the in danger list, adding, I think UNESCO are trying to force Australia's hand. That is why we have these international conventions. They're supposed to have teeth. She said there were two competing forces at play as Australia tries to make its lobbying count. Professor Morrison said this is actually about reputational risk, both from Australia and UNESCO's point of view, adding, the more Australia gets away with its lobbying, the more reputational damage there is to UNESCO. Dr. Simon Cripps, the Executive Director of Marine Conservation at the International Wildlife Conservation Society, says when a site makes its way onto the World Heritage List, as the Great Barrier Reef did back in 1981, it's not the end of a journey. Actually, it's the beginning. He says, as with your house or your car, sites need constant maintenance to keep them in a healthy condition. Australia is a land of environmental paradoxes, in that their fantastic work to conserve and sustainably manage the marine environment right around their coastline has set an example to so many other countries. He noted, yet it is undermined by their appalling performance on combating climate change that will cause huge environmental damage, social and economic damage to the very coast that they are seeking to protect. Back in Belize, the marine scientist and World Wildlife Fund campaigner Nadia Boud says it took plenty of political will to get her country's reef off the danger list. As a 15-year-old rural farm girl, Nadia Boud had never seen her country's famous barrier reef until she dived in for a school field trip. Boud, from her home in Belize City, says it was just like, wow, it was then I decided to be a marine scientist. She said, as humans, we're dependent on all the species. They allow us to live the life we're living. They give us our food and shelter, and the reef protects us from storms. She added, we have to try and protect them as much as possible. Australia and our reefs are sisters. We can be championing each other.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajil farajhum. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Previously, we started looking at the topic of corruption and how it undermines the essence of a human rights and basically deprives it of everything, which is something that me and you have to be very careful of and not to indulge in. We mentioned the definition. We mentioned how it happens, where it happens, and stuff like that. However, we looked at the fact that corruption, it goes back deep in history. Wherever there's laws, there seems to be corruption. Although that corruption has been occurring in societies ever since, it has only been given more attention in recent periods, because back in the day, we had no internet, we had no phone lines, we had no means of communication, and the world was separated. Sometimes, like, You don't even know what happened in the village next door because it wasn't even accessible because we had no means of transport except a camel, a horse, or a donkey. So it wasn't easy to access other cities. So when corruption happens, it happens in one place and no one gets to know about it. But as society developed, as civilization kept moving forward and forward, and we became more in touch with one another, and as we say now, the whole world became a small village where everyone knows everyone and everyone can get in touch with everyone, the phenomenon of corruption and its negative impact have become more common and more known through, obviously, research after 1995, when countries and international institutions began to be aware of this problem. So, as you all know, that after 1995, it was pretty much the peak of the internet, right? And things, I remember back in the day, 1995, where we started having dial-up connections, and you know, this device that dials and makes all these noises, and then you connect it to the world, and then for each page to load, it takes you, I don't know, a couple of minutes, even though it just takes a picture. It will take you a couple of minutes to upload a picture. But that time, it was so important and so sensitive that the whole world started to come together, and then we started interacting with one another. So after 1995, organizations and countries, they saw that we have a huge problem, which is corruption. And the attitude of the public towards corruption was until then neutral. Like, people didn't care much. And so after that, when, you know, people were starting to see how big of a problem it is, then people start to concern their voices. So, for example, in 1998, Kaufman and Gray, which they wrote an article concerning corruption, and they looked at a particular type of corruption. They looked at a bribery, for example, when, you know, they done a search, when they looked at the corruption through the form of bribery happening around the world. The information that they gave through their article was staggering, was mind-boggling, of how much the system is corrupted and how our essential rights are being taken without us even being aware, or without even being aware of the effects of such an action. Because sometimes when you say someone is dealing in bribes, we just don't care because we think it does not affect me. Right, I think it doesn't affect me, so who cares? But the reality is, it does so much. So they wrote a few points concerning to the fact of how bribery is so widely spread and affects people. Let's look at them one by one, but after we take a break. So stay with us.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are still listening to the program for humanity. Just before the break, I said Kaufman D. and Gray, they wrote an article called Corruption and Development in the Finance and Development Arena, and they were looking at corruption. So they said bribery is a widespread, especially in developing and transition countries. There are, however, significant difference between and within regions. So we assume that corruption happens where? In countries that are poor, in countries that have, you know, a very weak economy. True, it does happen. But actually, in fact, it is more widely spread in countries that are developed, civilized. because the smarter the system, the smarter the people that run it are, and they can manipulate such a system and get away with it. So even though it's widespread in developing nations and transition countries, there are, however, significant differences, though, between one region to another. So we can't say, well, yes, obviously the most developed, the most this, that, has the higher rate of bribery. It will always differ from one region to another. Therefore, we can't really point a finger at a specific nation or region. But generally speaking, in the most developed countries or in developed countries, bribery happens and is widespread. Two, they said, bribery increases transaction costs and creates insecurity in the economy, which is, you know, very simple, very straightforward, the effects of it, obviously. When there's bribery, the cost and the prices of things will go up, and the more they go up, it increases and it creates insecurities in the economy, where the economy itself is no longer stable. When the economy itself is no longer stable, people, me and you, we feel the heat. The sledgehammer falls on my head and your head. And if we look into our countries and the countries that, you know, surrounding us, or even in general, you see that when, for example, an oil company, for example, if the manager or the COO of such a company, he ends up stealing or taking bribes or whatever, he deals in corruption, the entire country will feel the heat. Why? Because the prices will go up, and I and you have to pay for that. So it creates a sense of insecurity. And this is just bribery by itself. And bribery is a fraction of corruption that happens. So it's just a tiny detail. It's not a, you know, it's not even a major thing if we look at other forms of corruption in other episodes to come. And then they said bribery usually leads in effective economic results. In long term, impedes foreign and domestic investments. Reallocates talent due to income and distort priorities when it comes to technology choices. And they give examples. So I don't want to go into the article because I'm running out of time. But you can see that it leads to an effective economy in the system. And obviously, when the economy is ineffective, you and I will feel such ineffectivity, and then we have to pay the price. Now, we will end here, and we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Salli ya Rabbi ala Qal al-Amin, rahmatin arsaltahu lil alamin. وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.